At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to another episode of the David Mead Podcast. On today's episode, we have Taylor Clement. Taylor, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you've been through a lot of shit throughout your life.
Yeah. That's one way to put it.
Yep. A lot more than most people I know. And yeah. Yet you've come out the other side and inspired a lot of other people, and myself included.
Oh, thank you.
I want to talk a bit about how you made that journey across. We spoke briefly yesterday on, and I asked how I could introduce you.
Yeah.
Because you're my quote-unquote first stranger on the podcast. Yeah. And I was going through your bio yesterday, and I saw on your Instagram, it said, the girl who can't smile. Before you talk about your upbringing, can you tell us a bit about the condition you were born with?
Yeah. So I was born with an extremely rare neurological disorder. It's called Mebius or Nobius syndrome, and it affects my 6th and 7th cranial nerves. So basically that means I have facial paralysis. So my eyebrows don't move, my eyes don't track from left to right, and my upper lip doesn't move, which means I can't smile, hence the Instagram bio, the girl who can't smile. And the syndrome is so rare that it affects one person in every 3 to 4 million. So it's super, super rare.
You can't smile with facial expression, but I can tell you what, seeing a lot of the videos that you've spoken on YouTube,
yeah,
you certainly put a lot of smiles on other people's faces, and you've got a lot of smile from your heart. So
thank you.
Certainly very inspiring.
Thank you. I also like to refer to it as free Botox.
Yeah. So where were you born in New Zealand, and what was it like growing up there?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Christchurch, New Zealand, so in the South Island, and moved away from Christchurch to the Kapiti Coast, which is like an hour from Wellington, around the age of 8, and then moved from Wellington to Tauranga, which is in the Bay of Plenty, in the kind of middle of the North Island, when I was 11 or... Yeah, just before my 11th birthday, and then lived in Tauranga for 4 years, and then have been up in Auckland since I was 16. So yeah, moved around quite a bit, and as you can probably assume, moving around a bit and starting new schools isn't easy for anyone, regardless of what you look like or whatever it is, but when you have that added extra of not being able to, I guess, smile at people or make those initial kind of connections with people through facial expression, it can be a bit harder. So I was bullied from a really young age, pretty much ever since I can remember, really. And yeah, do you want me to go into the bullying? Because I feel that's probably what you were hinting at.
I've got some questions here for you, but...
Okay.
Before we talk about the bullying stuff, what do you remember your earliest memories? What were some of the fun and exciting things to do where you were born?
I've always been a water baby. Like, I love the water. My mum was a NZ rep for surf life saving, water polo and swimming. So I feel like there was just always going to be a non-negotiable whether I loved it or not. But New Zealand, we're really lucky in New Zealand because we're pretty much all close to water and the ocean, and still to this day I love the ocean. Like, I'm such a summer person. I love summer, I love being by the water. So yeah, definitely going to the beach on the weekends for surf club, like Nippers. I'm pretty sure they have like Nippers in Australia. I'm not sure it's called Nippers, so I could be mistaken.
Is it called Nippers, Jay? Nippers. I've never been into it, so I'm not too familiar with it.
Yeah, so it was just like all these like little kids running around the sand, causing havoc, throwing sand at each other. But yeah, no, that was super fun. And that's probably one of my earliest like good memories. Yeah.
Yep. And so from then on, when did you realize the bullying was starting? Do you remember that?
I would say I kind of realized maybe there was something different about me when I would like go to the supermarket with my mum, and this was like super young as well, like maybe 4 or 5. And my mum would like stop people from staring at me, and like she's super passive aggressive, my mum, bless her. But she would like stop people in the supermarket that I like should either like confront them if they were staring, or should be like, my daughter has this, this, and this, righty, righty, right, and like should start a conversation with them about it. And some people were like open to have the conversation if I can remember correctly, and some just weren't. So, but yeah, that was probably my first kind of memory of realizing I was a bit different than others.
Yeah, it must have been like pretty frustrating for your mum feeling like she had to explain herself, because.
I can't imagine what it would have been like for her, because like I said, the syndrome's 1 in every 3 to 4 million. So when I was first diagnosed, like she told me that she went on to all the American websites for medias, because obviously America's got like a way bigger population than New Zealand has got. And I don't think, I mean, there still aren't that many people with medias in New Zealand currently. But there was always going to be like a bigger population of people with the syndrome in the States. So she said she would like go onto the forums and everything. But yeah, I can't imagine what it would be like for parents to like have a child that is like different and they don't know kind of how to deal with it. But my parents are super chill and like just, I think they've done it so well. They always say that they're not the best parents, but like I love my parents so much, and yeah, like they're both my best friends, and just really thankful for how they've brought me up as a person, because I think that comes back to who I am today as well, and how I've been able to deal, I guess, with having the syndrome.
And yeah, did your mum find she obviously found some, did her homework and found some more information that must have given her some form of, I guess, how would you say, comfort, knowing that there's other people dealing with that as well?
I feel like it's the same for everyone. If you've got something that you're dealing with, the first thing you want to do is find someone else that maybe has dealt with what you are dealing with, and kind of take kind of inspiration from them and how they've dealt with it. I take my hat off to her. I'm not sure if I could have done it.
With the bullying in school, it must have been pretty hard. How do you think, or do you remember how you used to deal with it? It must have been very upsetting.
I would say I didn't deal with it well, because I didn't tell anyone. I didn't really even tell my mum or my dad really until I was out of school, and they still don't know half the stuff that I went through, just because I don't want them to have to feel bad or like they could have done anything, because there was nothing that they could have done. And it's just, there's not really much point in me telling them, because I just don't want them to feel bad, like they're amazing parents. So I'd rather just keep that to myself and keep it for podcasts like this, to like to be educational for other people. And yeah,
when you say you didn't talk to anyone about it, were you obviously affected by a lot of the bullying growing up?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. I guess I'm trying to get this out in a way where, like, if other kids are getting bullied at school.
Mm-hmm. Don't do what I did. Yeah. Don't do what I did. Definitely talk about it with someone that you trust. So for me, the reason kind of why at the time I didn't tell my parents about what I was going through is because one of the things I would get told, like maybe not daily, but, you know, at least definitely weekly at times, was that my parents didn't love me, or that I was a mistake, or that I shouldn't be alive. And so when you're like a really young kid and you've already gone through all this like bullying and exclusion, and then you're getting told that you're parents don't love you or that you're a mistake on top of that, you don't have that kind of maturity in terms of like mindset to be able to differentiate between what's true and what isn't. So for me, I believed that my parents didn't love me, and that took me down a pretty dark path, along with everything else that I went through. But yeah, it was super hard for me to feel like my parents didn't love me, but they obviously did. But to anyone that is being bullied, like right now, or will be bullied in the future, or who is going through something now that they feel like they can't talk to anyone about, you 100% can talk about it. And the more you talk about it, but it gets 100% easier. Like, even just talking about it for the first time, like, it's, I know how hard it is to like open up to people when you feel like you're dealing with something on your own, that you're not alone by any means, and it, like, you can't deal with it by yourself. Like, it's impossible to deal with such negativity on your own, and the more you open up to people, like, 100% gets so much easier.
For sure, 100% agree with that. Just out of curiosity, how bad did the bullying get? Because,
okay, so I made a promise to myself when I started on this journey of, I guess, quote unquote, inspiring people, that I was going to leave nothing unsaid. So I'm going to go into it like in full detail, and you can stop me at any point if you think if it gets a bit too much.
This is your show, Taylor. You say as much as you want.
So the bullying started pretty much when I entered school. I had friends when I was in primary and lived in Christchurch and everything, because I'd semi growing up, you know, gone to kindergarten with these kids. And when you're a bit younger, you don't really care too much about what other people look like, right? You kind of just go with the flow. All you want to do is go to school, have fun, and eat your lunch and play games. So it was all kind of good in Christchurch. Got called a few names here and there, but nothing to like write home about. When I moved from Christchurch to the Kapiti Coast, around the age of 8 or 9, that's when I started experiencing a lot of exclusion and not being like invited to people's houses, or I found it really hard to make friends when I moved that first time. And the friends that I did have, people would like tell them to not be friends with me because I looked different, or that I couldn't smile, or that I was weird. And so that was kind of like my first real taste of like kind of proper bullying, I guess. And then when I moved to Tauranga, a couple of years after that, that's when the bullying got really bad. So I had an operation, a really invasive operation, just after I turned 11, and the operation was supposed to be able to make me smile. So they took tissue from the right side of my leg and they inserted it internally in the insides of my mouth, from the corners of my mouth up into my temple. So the idea was that I'd be able to clench down my teeth and that the tissue inserted would pull up the corners of my mouth to smile. And of course, like, I wanted it so badly. All I wanted was to be able to smile, because in my head I was like, if I can smile, then I won't be bullied anymore. And the operation was unsuccessful. And it was 6 or 7 months after that when I took the first of what would be 6 attempts on my life, because I was, to be quite honest, I don't think I realized what I was doing, because it was such a young age to want to do something like that. But I was so like disheartened and depressed that I couldn't smile, and I was already going through so much. And I'd started a new school that year, because when you turn 12 in New Zealand, that's the end of primary school, so then you go into intermediate and high school. So started a new school with like my face like out to here, like I had, the swelling didn't go down for like a good year. And I can send you pictures, or like send you links to put over like the YouTube video, whatever, if you want me to, and because it's a interesting visual to look at. But I started this new school with like bruised face, bruised under eyes, like face like looking like a puffer fish. And if you thought like not being able to smile was enough, going and starting a new school looking like that, and then also not being able to smile, like still not being able to smile after that operation, it not only like broke me as a 11, 12 year old kid, but it also made other people not want to be friends with me. I remember my mum coming into school halfway through that year during a lunchtime, and I didn't know she was coming, and I was sitting by myself because I didn't have any friends, and I was eating my lunch, and mum goes, "Oh, where's like all your friends?" And I was like, "Oh, they're coming from class. They're just a bit like And that's kind of when the whole lying started for me about like what I was going through to my parents. And I felt like it was easier than telling the truth, which it 100% wasn't. And again, I'll say it again, like tell the truth, like let people know what you're going through. But yeah, that kind of is what started the whole not telling people what I was going through. End of that year, so year 7 going into year 8 is when the physical bullying started. So people would come up behind me and rip my bag off my back, or and they'd like take all my school books out of my bag and throw them everywhere. And they would take my lunch box out of my bag and like throw my lunch everywhere. And I'd be like, you know what, you can take my bag, you can take my school books, just for God's sakes, don't take my lunch. Your girl needs her food. But yeah, so that happened. And then people would like come up behind me when I would be walking upstairs, and they would like kick my knee in from behind, so I'd fall over. So I have like these grazes and scars on my knees from that. And it happened so many times that I ended up tearing my meniscus in my left knee, because I got to a point where I knew it was going to happen. And so the force of me like kind of hyperextending my knee and then kicking it like tore my meniscus like completely. And the doctor, when I went to him, was like, oh, how did you do this? And I was like, oh, I was like running, which is like such a lie, because I don't run, like if I hate running. Yeah, so that happened. And I'd get pushed down hills, and our school that I was on at this time was like on farmland, and so people would like get sheep poo and like throw sheep poo at me, which is like the most Kiwi thing ever. But yeah, and then end of that year going into the following year, so end of year 8 going into year 9, is when I started experiencing rape and sexual assault for the first time. So that happened over the span of 2 years, so from then until when I left Tauranga. And I had no idea what rape or sexual assault was at that age. I don't think anyone really did at that age. All I knew what rape and sexual assault was from the movie. So I thought it was like you get kidnapped and blindfolded and thrown into a back of a truck and raped and then killed. I didn't know anything different. And so that was a huge part of my recovery process, which I'm sure we'll get into later. And then yeah, just like name calling, of like being told my parents didn't love me, getting barked at by people, being called a dog, being called a pig, ugly, all this sort of stuff. And I remember this one time I got asked over to like a sleepover party, and it was in the middle of summer, so like we were all going to sleep outside in tents and everything. So we were like asked to bring a sleeping bag and everything, and like I was so excited because this was like one of my first ever sleepovers. I must have been about 15 at the time. And mum dropped me off, rocked up to the house and knocked on the door, and like a couple of girls came to the door, and they were all like giggling and talking between themselves. And I knew something wasn't right. And then I was like, I'm here for the sleepover. And then they're like, oh, you weren't invited. And I was like, oh, but I got the invitation. They're like, oh, you weren't invited. And they like laughed and shut the door in my face. So I didn't want to text mum and tell her that I wasn't invited, because then I'd have to tell her everything else. So I walked down the road and slept in a bus shelter that night, and then just told my mum that I'd walk home the following day, so I wouldn't have to like tell her what was going on. So that kind of happened a couple of times after that. And then groups of girls that I'd be friends with, or like quote unquote friends with, would like get guys to pretend to be into me, and invite me out on dates and everything. And then no one would show up, and they would like be there and taking pictures of me and put them on these like Facebook groups that they've made. And yeah, so just like a lot of that. And then moving away from Tauranga, was up in Auckland for my last 3 years of school. And I was up here for the first year by myself with my dad. And then mum and my other sister came up at the end of that first year. I was up here by myself. And I kind of was just like done. I was done with school at that point, and wagged a lot, lied about where I was sometimes. I laugh about it now because it's so stupid, but sometimes I would like literally just leave school and go across the road and sit under a tree. Like I could like like the school was like probably 20 meters away from me, and I'd just be sitting there just like chilling under a tree, just like sweet, like people don't even know I'm here, and like I'm obviously in a school uniform. But yeah, so I don't condone wagging school at all, but like that's just kind of the mindset I was in. Like I didn't like I was so traumatized. And then 2015 was my last year of school, and that's kind of when everything started to take a real downhill turn for me. It was about maybe a quarter of the way through the schooling year, I want to say, and I started just having these collapsing episodes and seizures. So I had one or two at school, and then after I had my one or two, they asked me to leave school, and because apparently I was a risk to other students. But in my head I was like, yes, like I don't have to go to school anymore. This is like it. This is like the dream come true for me. I was in and out of hospital all of 2015 and into 2016. And basically they did all these tests on me. They thought I was like had a brain aneurysm. They thought there's something wrong with my heart because I was like having up at one point up to 8 or 9 seizures a day. Which was like
Jeez.
super dangerous in itself. Yeah, like it got really bad for a while there. And I think it was about March or April of 2016 where I was finally diagnosed with extreme clinical depression, anxiety with post-traumatic stress disorder, and dissociative attacks or Addisonia's crisis, which is usually only diagnosed in patients who su suffer, who are in severe car accidents. Or who go through trauma out of nowhere. But because my trauma that I'd been through with like my bullying and the depression and everything had gone on for so long and was so extreme, I was diagnosed with Addisonia's crisis or dissociative attacks, which is when your cortisol levels are so low, and cortisol is the hormone that is your fight or flight response. So like when you're faced with like a anxiety driven situation or you're in a situation where you have to kind of fight or flight, that's when your cortisol levels kick in. But because mine was so low and almost non-existent, my brain was shutting down. Because it obviously had no fight or flight response, so instead I was having seizures. So that I was told that I was never gonna recover from those. I was told that I was gonna have seizures for the rest of my life, and here we are today, and I haven't had a seizure in like 2 years, and pretty much fully recovered. Still deal with a little bit of anxiety from time to time, but I'm pretty much all good.
Yeah. Wow, that's geez, I mean, if that's how I'm feeling, like, wow, that's a lot to deal with, especially as a kid, teenager, dealing with all that type of stuff.
I do believe everything happens for a reason, though, and although it was like really hard for me, and I wouldn't wish it upon anyone at all in this world, I believe that I went through it for a reason, and this is one of those reasons to like talk with you and inspire your community to talk about mental health and just kind of inspire people to realize that you only get one life, and don't take it for granted at all. And it really doesn't matter like what you look like or where you come from and what the color of your skin is or whatever it is that you think might stop you. Like you can achieve anything you want to achieve, and that's what I really like am so passionate about. So yeah, I wouldn't take it back for the world.
When you were talking to your family about this, I know you mentioned earlier you haven't, they don't know everything, but when you started telling them, they must have been pretty upset by it.
Oh yeah.
How did you all deal with it?
Yeah, well, my mum was pretty easy to talk to about it. She's a real like carefree type of person. Like she's really go with the flow. Like she nothing really phases her, and I know anyone can get mental health issues or deal with depression or anxiety, but she's just one of those people that I just don't feel like could ever be depressed. She's just like super, like always pretty happy and chill and go with the flow. Whereas my dad, it was super hard to talk to him about, especially like the rape and sexual assault, because he just retired last year after 42 years in the police. And he was quite a high level in the New Zealand police as well. And we're very similar, my dad and I. Like, if I was born a boy, I think I would have been like a spitting image of him. But we have very similar mindsets in the way we think and the way we go about life. And it was, yeah, pretty hard to talk to him about, especially the sexual assault and rape, just because he's dealt with stuff like that before. And I think as a parent, you always think that it could never happen to your child, or your child's always going to be safe from all the stuff. But yeah, it was super hard to talk to him about. But I think we just get each other without having to talk too much about stuff, which is really nice. But I know that if I really needed to talk to him about something, then he would always be there. And but yeah, I think they were pretty in shock. And every time I talk to my sister about it, she's just like, you just wouldn't have known. You just wouldn't have known that that's what I was going through, because I like tried my best to make sure no one knew that that is what I was going through, because I didn't want to be, I don't know, I don't like to cause anyone like any like sadness, or like I don't want to like upset people or anything. So I just wanted to make sure that everyone else was fine before I was fine. So, and I'm still like that today, but I'm very aware of where I'm at now. So that's kind of the difference between younger Taylor and this Taylor.
Yep. And from turning your pain into your power, when I was reading in your bio, can you give us an example or two how you're able to turn your pain into your power? Can you give us an
So
example?
one of the biggest things is my smile. So when I was 11 and had that operation, the only thing I wanted was to be able to smile, because it had already caused me so much pain up until that point, and then it continued to cause me pain after the operation was unsuccessful. But looking back on it now, one, I understand why the operation was unsuccessful in my head, and two, I'm very grateful that it was unsuccessful, because my smile is what makes me, and I feel so empowered that I like had something to show people that it's like, okay, if I can do it, then so can you. You know, like I'm not any different from anyone else. I'm not special. I've just been able to go through something, or go through a lot of things, and come out the other side. And I guess my smile has enabled me to do what I do today, and that's kind of like my biggest source of turning pain into power. And people probably think I'm crazy, but I'd go through it all again if I had to, because it is so empowering to be able to stand here like as the woman that I am today after going through so much, and be like, you know what, it happened, it's the past, right now is kind of all we have, and if I can use what I've been through to help others, then that's what I'm going to do, and that's what I know that I'm here to do. So yeah.
What does power feel like to you? You excited, not scared anymore? You feel free?
I wouldn't call it power. I kind of just use pain into power as like kind of the sentence, but I'd call it more empowerment. I think empowerment feels pretty much like you can do anything, or that you can achieve anything really. Like it's really weird, because I used to walk up Mount Maunganui, which is in Tauranga, where I used to live for a bit, and where a lot of the bullying happened. And I would walk up this mount, and with my family sometimes, or sometimes just with my dad or my mum, and they would go do their own thing, and I'd like, this is going to sound so cheesy, but I'd stand on like the edge of the mountain, like looking out across the ocean, and the only thing I would pray for or ask for or wish for was to be happy. Like that's all I wanted, like as a 13, 14, 15-year-old kid, like that's all I wanted. I just wanted the bullying to stop, and I just wanted to be happy. So to be able to stand here and say that, like, I truly am like the happiest person ever, and like the confidence that I have, and the ability to connect with people as well. Like it's truly such a gift to be able to turn what I've been through into empowerment. And it's really special, and I don't ever take it for granted at all.
Yeah, man, that's a although you wish that, you know, none of those things happen to anyone, you're a living example of someone who can, you know, take their situation and turn it into a positive. And I hope that this conversation gets heard throughout a lot of places, especially in PNG, because, you know, and I know there's a lot of social issues there. There's a lot of problems there, and I just don't know if the help is out there and available.
And this is also why I do stuff like this as well, because some people feel like they don't know where to reach out to, they don't know where to start, they don't know how to talk about what they're going through, and all you've got to do is just start. Like, there's never going to be a right time, there's never going to be a right place to start, but you've just got to do it, because the more time you waste feeling all these negative emotions, the more you're going to bring yourself down, and also the more of your life that you're wasting. You know, like, we're not supposed to be sad and depressed all the time. Like, there's so much, like, to be alive in itself is just a blessing. So I think it's really important that people understand that they, like, need to talk about how they're feeling, even if you're not feeling depressed or anxious or anything. Like, just talk about how you're feeling and making it sort of like the norm is super powerful as well.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with that. Yeah. I spoke to you, I saw a little bit briefly in your bio, and I spoke to you a little bit briefly yesterday. You enjoy doing some form of meditation?
Yeah.
I guess for me, that's a way I wouldn't say I deal with problems, but that's how I feel sometimes empowered.
Yeah.
I guess because I'm less reactive, you know, either sitting upright or laying down. I'll close my eyes for 10, 15 minutes and just try and see my thoughts pass. And I find that helps me with, you know, dealing with the kids screaming all afternoon, or, you know, driving and someone's cutting me off. Did you
use... That's so funny.
Yeah, well, yeah, it happens a lot. I try to use meditation for...
A lot of things,
especially screaming kids. Is that one way you were able to deal with a lot of your things? Because I see meditation is, how would you put it? It's becoming more and more common to talk about.
Yeah.
And more and more, done a lot more now. It's somewhere, something I want to explore. And you said you had a huge interest in this area as well.
Yeah, 100%. I think there's a couple of places where people kind of get put off meditation. One is the fact that it's called meditation and it sounds like super like weird, but if you don't want to look at it that way, just look at it as breath work, because that's essentially what it is. It's focusing on your breath and all of that. And the second reason why people find it so hard to meditate or do breath work is because they think they're an overthinker and they find it hard to switch off. And I'm 100% that sort of person. Like, I'm such an overthinker, and it's something that I'm getting a lot better at. But the reason I didn't get into meditation for so long was because I thought, oh, I'm an overthinker and I'm never going to be able to switch my thoughts off. And that's like the whole wrong idea people have about meditation. Meditation isn't about switching your thoughts off. It's about being able to go to a really calm and zen place and just be the observer of your thoughts, rather than running around like a headless chicken and also having these like millions and trillions of thoughts going around in your head all at one time. And being able to go into a place, even if it's for like 3 minutes, like if you feel like you can't do it, just set a timer for 3 minutes and just really focus on your breath, like in through your nose, out through your mouth, and just focus on your breath and watch how calm you are when you come out of it. And as you get better and better at it, you can, you know, put the time up and up. But the more I got into meditation, the more I was able to observe kind of the thoughts and beliefs and feelings that I was allowing myself to believe. And it all comes back to mindset. Like, this all ties back into mindset, and I'm like huge on mindset. Mindset is the thing that kind of got me out of my depression and anxiety and really get me to a place where I am today of empowerment and confidence in myself and what I want to achieve. But when you meditate, you're able to kind of hear what you're telling yourself on a daily basis. And sometimes you don't even realize that you're telling yourself these thoughts. And your reality, like what we're living right now, is a direct reflection of what you think and allow yourself to believe. You know, so you could be, and this is like from like when you grow up as a child as well, you know, the the way you've been brought up, the stories that you hear as you're growing up from like teachers or parents, or limiting beliefs that you get from the media or whatever it is. You know, we've all been conditioned to think a certain way and live a certain way and be a certain way. And when you take control of that, that's when you start living like your best life and you get the most out of life and you become, I guess, who you want to be, if that makes sense.
Well, I think it's certainly a helpful tool. I think, you know, someone like you who's experienced the bad experience you had in your teenage years, if meditation is something you endorse, I think it's certainly well worth looking into by people out there. Now, I want to talk a little bit about participating in the Paralympics.
Yeah.
That must have been pretty exciting.
Yeah, so it wasn't, so I never, so I was a Paralympic athlete and I competed for New Zealand in swimming and shot put and discus. So people get really confused because the Paralympics is like the Olympics, but for people who have disabilities, right? But being a Paralympic athlete and going to the Paralympics are two different things. So I was a Paralympic athlete and I never got around to going to the Paralympics, but we will get into that. But so I quit swimming when I was about 19 and competed for New Zealand overseas, went to the Pan Pacific Games, which is like a which is sort of like a mini Olympics. It's got all of the countries apart from like Europe, so Spain and England and stuff like that don't go, but the Americas go, and all of those sort of countries. And competed in Australia heaps, went to heaps of Australian national championships. Did pretty well. Nothing like, had a few New Zealand records and Oceania records and all that, but then had to quit when I was 19 due to my mental health stuff, and then I was supposed to like be focusing fully on my recovery, but because I'm like a super fidgety person and can't really sit still, I was given an opportunity to give shot put a go, and I was like, why not? I've got nothing else to do. Literally, all I was doing was going to therapy every week and kind of talking about my feelings, which got a bit dragged out quite a bit after a while. So this was like 2016, but at the end of 2016. So rocked up to this athletics track, went into the middle where the shot put kind of place was, and the guy that I was standing there with, he was just like, okay, just do what you did in primary school, throw the shot put and we'll see how it goes. So I stood in the shot put circle and he was like, just throw it. And I was like, okay. So I just did it, and he stood there and kind of like his jaw dropped a little bit and said nothing and just went straight onto his side. And I was like standing there, I was like, well, can someone tell me what's going on, please? Because I don't know what's happening. And I didn't know if it was good at anything, but he got on his phone, texted someone, and like three other people came over from the national head office like 5 minutes after that. And he was like, okay, throw it again. And I was like, well, now there's a lot of pressure because there are more people here. So I gave it a throw and they measured it and they were like, Taylor, you just broke the New Zealand record in your classification. And I was like, oh, sweet. Like, that's pretty cool. And so they're like, do you know, like, sign up to a club and like give it a go? And I was like, yeah, okay. And then that same day I got a call back and they're like, oh, you're going to go into the New Zealand team to Australia next year in Melbourne. To get your international classification and compete. And I was like, oh, no, thank you. I was like, that's not going to happen. Because I was still, like, struggling so much with my anxiety at this point. And I was like, and because, like, my parents couldn't come with me, and I was like, there's no way. There's no way that that's happening. Anyway, February of 2017 rocks around, and I end up going on this trip, get my international classification. And this, so this was my first ever competition, and it was an international one. And I ended up throwing the distance that got me world number one in my classification. And I thought they were joking when they called out the like medal presentation and everything, and they were like, Taylor Clement from New Zealand and is now world number one. I was like, someone is playing one big prank on me, because this shit is just not real.
So obviously confused.
Oh, I so was, yeah. And because, like, obviously I was like still struggling with anxiety, and they had like this like really mini like media conference after it, just like to like the local newspaper. And because I was like so nervous, they asked me a question and I was just like, no comment. And I was like, why did I say this? I was like, and then I was so embarrassed. I was like, oh my god. And I was just like, okay, I'm done.
See, how do you feel winning
New Zealand now?
How do you feel being number one? No comment.
Yeah, literally, that's what it was. And I was just like, oh, that's so embarrassing for my country, for my family, for myself. I'm going back home. But yeah, so I was like, okay, no more media for Taylor. That was bad. Anyway, trained pretty much full-time all of 2017 and 18. 2019 rolls around, and it was so I was trying to qualify for World Champs, which were in 2019. So I rocked up to New Zealand Nationals, hadn't had the best of run-ins with my training and everything, had to swap coaches like 3 weeks out from Nationals, which is like a pretty big like upset to happen like 3 weeks out from like one of the major competitions. Anyway, was just kind of at a point where I was like, okay, I know what I'm capable of. I know I can do it. It's all good. Just chill out, have fun, and see what happens. Anyway, compete at Nationals and end up throwing a distance that broke the world record and qualified for Worlds as well, which was so cool. Like, I was not expecting it. I didn't even know what, like, I was so new to the sport that I didn't even know what the world record was in my classification. And again, I was like, nah, this, like, this doesn't happen to people, you know, like, this does not happen to people, like, so quickly. And so I was, like, super excited and everything. And then I got injured about a month or two after that. And I was about 4 months out from Worlds. So I had to make the decision whether I was going to just train through and, like, possibly have to deal with this injury for the rest of my life, or was I going to stop and take some time out and heal and then go to Worlds like untrained pretty much. And so I took some time off, and while I was taking that time off, I just realized that I was like a lot happier and a lot I guess I didn't realize that my mental health was going downhill again. And I never went into this, I never went into athletics or shot put to be world number one or to break a world record. Like, that was just stuff that happened. You know, I didn't like have that in the back of my mind, like, I'm training for this, I'm training to get here, I'm training to do this and everything, you know. And that's what people were telling me all around me. They're like, you're gonna go to the Paralympics, you're gonna get a gold medal, you're gonna do all this. And I was like, yeah, that's cool and everything, but I'm just doing this because I'm alive and I'm lucky to be alive and like I enjoy it. And so over the injury break, I was just like, I'm really not enjoying athletics anymore. And so I decided to call it quits, and it was the best decision I ever made. So, yeah.
Oh, at least you worked that out pretty early and
yeah.
Went from
and there. Also, I didn't want to be in a position where I was going to give more of my time to the sport when I wasn't happy. And I also didn't want people to invest in me, like sponsors and everything, when I wasn't happy and I couldn't say that I was going to give it my best when I wasn't in the best mindset and headspace, if that makes sense. So, yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. When was that your first time in Australia?
No. My parents took me over to Great Barrier Island when I was like 2 or 3 or something.
Yeah.
No, I don't think it was Great Barrier. It was one of the islands. And then we've been to the Gold Coast heaps.
Gold Coast is a good spot.
Oh, I love the Gold Coast. Yeah. Yeah, super fun. All the theme parks was always, like, so fun when we went over there as kids and stuff. Although I'm traumatised from Whitewater World, like, never going back there in my life.
Really? I used to work there when I was 19, playing in the under-20s.
Oh, my God. Oh, so you know that slide that drops, like, you're standing in it and it drops from underneath you?
Yeah.
Worst bloody experience of my life. Never doing it again. Like, honestly, I could not breathe the whole way down and I thought I was going to die, but I didn't. May have been over-exaggerating a bit, but, like, oh, my God, the fear that ran through my body on that ride.
I think it's my brother-in-law. He's close to 30 now, over 30 now. I think we went to that same slide a couple of years ago, just off topic a little bit. And because there's two of them, my sister told him in front, he never wanted to do it. And my sister asked him to do it in front of the whole family, so he had no choice but to actually go and do it. So I'll certainly be showing him this part. I want to put him on the spot a bit because he loves to give me a lot of shit.
But, my God.
I'm pretty sure they had an argument after that for making him do it. So, Dan.
That's so good. Yeah, that's the worst when you're forced into it as well, and you already know you don't want to do it, and, like, people are forcing you, and it's like, okay, I'll do it. And then it just ends up being so much worse than what you thought it was going to be.
Yeah. I used to love working at that place, White Water World. I think it certainly defined some part of my career, I reckon.
Yeah.
I used to wake up in under 20s, go to training at like 5, 6 a.m.
Yeah.
And then go to White Water World, work from 8 till 4, and then rush off back to training in the afternoon.
Shit. Yeah. That's a long day.
Yeah, I think. A lot of the under-20s guys had to do some form of work or study. Yeah. So. But anyway.
But what a place to work, though. How fun was that, watching people scream and feel like they're going to...
Yeah, it was fun for about 2-3 weeks. And then because the octopus ride... the octopus one, I think it's called, the one with the 8 slides where you race.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Yeah, that one I didn't like working on because you tell everyone to wait.
And they wouldn't.
They wouldn't wait and go, and I'd be like, yeah. I think my time's up at this place.
Oh my God.
Maybe I wasn't commanding enough, but anyway.
So good.
Anyway, there's a little bit of interesting facts for you guys. You didn't know me before playing first grade. So I'd like to ask a little bit of fun rapid fire questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is, did you ever have a pre-competition ritual before you went in?
Oh, people are gonna drag me for this one, but oh, they might not, but before I broke the world record the first time in shot put, and again when I broke it the second time, the only song I listened to before I went on, like about 20 minutes, like just the whole 20 minutes before I went on, was Sweet Home Alabama by Lynyrd Skynyrd.
For 20 minutes straight, on repeat.
I don't know why. I didn't even like country music at the time. And this was before country music was like in, because you know how country music is like in at the moment?
Yeah.
Like this was 5 years ago, and I don't know why, but something about it was really calming. And so I'd listen to it for like 20 minutes on repeat.
Oh, well, there you go. What's your favorite type of gym music? I'm guessing it's... not country, or is it country?
I feel like country's a bit slow for like workout music. I really like up tempo stuff. I like a lot of just like fast music. I don't like have the genre, but just like really up tempo, like the generic Spotify gym playlists of what I listen to.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite saying or quote?
I have a couple, but one that I'm really pushing at the moment is if I can do it, then so can you, and no one is you, and that is your power.
Oh, nice. I like that. That's the first time I've ever heard that one.
Yeah, it's a good one.
If you were to describe yourself in one word.
Don't do this to me. Can I have three?
You can have three.
Okay. So three words to describe myself.
Yeah.
Fun, sarcastic, and confident.
Nice.
Very sarcastic.
I couldn't tell. If there's an animal that best describes your positive attitude, what would that animal be?
Probably a dolphin.
Oh, nice. Yes.
I'm not as flexible as a dolphin, and I can't move like a dolphin, but I feel like dolphins are very like carefree, and they love the water because obviously they live in the water.
Yeah, they look like a lot of fun too.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely a dolphin.
What's your favorite meal?
I love katsuobi. Do you guys have that in Australia?
What's it called?
Katsubi. It's like a Japanese, how would I describe that? It's like a Japanese, like I love like Asian food. Well, I like Asian food and Mexican food, but katsubi is like this Japanese dish and it's rice, salads, and everything. And then like teriyaki chicken or sweet and chili chicken. I don't know. It's like, I'll have to send you a link to their website and so you can see if you've got it in Australia, but it's like my fave go-to.
Yeah, geez, you've nearly sold me on that. It's only 11 a.m. here, but I'm getting hungry. Where's your favorite spot to visit in New Zealand?
Oh, I definitely love Christchurch. Christchurch will always be home for me. But Raglan is beautiful, a really nice like surf town, super cultural, and I really love it there. Northland, have you ever been to New Zealand before?
I've been to Auckland because whenever we play the Warriors there.
Yeah.
I did do a trip away with a couple of the lads to Queenstown. That's a beautiful spot.
Yeah, Queenstown
spot
is super nice, but that's like a very like generic touristy spot. Like it's like super, oh, don't get me wrong, Queenstown's like stunning. But if you ever come to New Zealand, I'd definitely suggest going up north to Northland and the far north. So like Whangarei, Kaihia, up those ways, because just some of the most amazing oceans and just like just so beautiful up there, and like the culture is amazing up there, and yeah, really, really nice.
And you mentioned Raglan before. That's Jordan Ricci's place of birth, I believe it was. I think you mentioned that.
Is it?
Yeah, I think.
I thought he was a Christchurch boy, or was I wrong about that?
I'll have to listen to the podcast again. just the Raglan sound real familiar. But that's
it's super nice there.
Yeah. Just before we wrap up, I want to talk a few about things about your public speaking engagements. I think you've done a few talks with a few rugby teams or a few sporting teams.
Yeah.
You mentioned yesterday that you were, you know, still nervous about public speaking. How did you find that talking in front of those teams?
Well, I think I told you the other day, but my first ever, so like before I did anything, my first ever speaking gig was in front of the North Harbour Mitre 10 men's team. And I was only about 20 at the time. And when you put a shy little 20-year-old girl in front of a group of fully grown men who are also rugby players, like, it scared the living daylights out of me. I'm not kidding you. I was shitting myself. I was so close to, like, calling and being like, sorry, I can't come anymore. Like, I'm not doing it. But, yeah, that was definitely a definitive moment in my life where I was like, okay, this is something that I want to get better at, and it's something I want to pursue. It was super like scary for like the first 10 minutes, but as I got into it, and like they were all so lovely, like the loveliest group of people ever, and then like some of their management staff was in with them as well, and just like such a lovely environment to be in. And yeah, it got easier. Probably wasn't my best talk I've ever done, but yeah, just, and I still like talk to some of the guys now, and they, because my sister's boyfriend plays for a club here on the North Shore in Auckland, and they play for clubs here on the North Shore. So whenever we see each other, we always say hi and like ask how everyone's doing and everything. So like just really formed a lot of amazing connections through that first ever talk. So that was like really cool. And then went down to the Crusaders that same year, a couple months after, and did that again. And I was in the same mindset. I was like, why am I doing this to myself again? Why did I say that I would do this again? I don't want to do it anymore. And this was like an even bigger group because it was their pre-season training squad as well. So it was their Super Rugby squad and their pre-season squad.
Do you remember what you said to them? This is a big rugby team in New Zealand, right? The Crusaders.
Yeah. Yeah, I do sort of, and I've always said to the lady who I speak with from the Crusaders that I want a do-over because I do so much better now. But the most amazing group of people ever, and you like you can go into that. Like I went into that environment not expecting much, and really learning a lot from them as well. Like you can. it was pretty evident to me why they are so good at what they do, and just the processes that they have and the mindset that they all have, and really like coming together as a team and everything. But they asked amazing questions, and they were also like invested in what I was saying, which was really cool. Like I was expecting some of them to like fall asleep or whatever, or like look the other way, but they were all just like looking at me the whole time. I was like, you guys can like look away for a bit if you want, like you don't have to keep looking. But yeah, and then the following day I went and did a training session with them, which was like so much fun. Loved that so much. And yeah, I want a do-over, so hopefully I'll get a do-over hopefully for the next season, which would be cool. Yeah,
that would be cool. I know you want to get into public speaking, you want to go do talking gigs around. Is there anything that you'd like to promote or say about, you know, what you want to do?
Well, I think for now, especially in kind of a state that not just New Zealand and Australia are in at the moment with the whole pandemic, but I think just the world in general, like there's been a lot more talk about mental health in the last couple of years, and it's amazing, and I love seeing people talk about mental health. But globally, our suicide statistics are still so high, like the highest they've ever been. And so to me, that kind of says that we need to keep doing more and keep talking about it more. And even if it's just sharing something that someone else has posted on their Instagram, or saying something to someone else that someone else has said, like I know it can be super hard to talk about mental health, and to especially open up to people who you are close with about mental health, because there's always that fear of judgment or they're not understanding. And if you think that someone that you know is going through some sort of mental health struggle, I know it can be hard to know what to say. But even just like saying to someone like, look, it's okay if you're struggling, and I'm not entirely sure how I'm going to help you, but just know that I'm here and we can do it together, like that would do like the world of difference for so many people. Like suicide is one of the very few like deaths in this world that we can stop, because people don't have to take their own lives. And I know we can't save anyone, which like breaks my heart, but we can save a lot of people by talking about mental health more and making it more aware, and even just talking about our feelings more. Like it's really not hard. We can go to the doctor and talk about us like our physical sicknesses, or we can go and get a broken bone looked at, but we can't talk about our like emotions, which yeah, like confuses me a little bit. But it's, yeah, I wish like I could do a whole podcast on talking about mental health, but I think it's so important to just talk about mental health. And even this podcast, I think will help, I hope will help a lot of people that may not have felt comfortable talking about mental health or hearing about mental health, and starting that kind of getting the ball rolling and talking about there. Just talk as much as you can about it within your training teams, within your playing teams, within your rugby community. Like it doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, what colour skin you have, who you love, what you believe in, the money you have in your bank, what kind of car you drive. It does not matter. Mental health does not discriminate. And it's super important to be as open as we can about it.
For sure. I think I just based off what you're saying there, I read in a book, it's called A Force for Good by Dalai mm-hmm. Lama.
Yeah.
And he mentioned that over the next 100 years, I think the most important thing will be dialogue.
Yeah,
people, 100%. People talking to each other, and that certainly applies to mental health.
Yeah.
Taylor, I want to thank you for being a guest on this podcast. And this has opened my mind up to a whole new world of awareness. I know people talk about bullying and stuff in primary school, but I haven't spoken to anyone in depth about it. So that certainly opened up my mind to that side. You know, you shared briefly about the sexual assault, rape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, just being able to express that and make others feel like they can express themselves, and, you know, they can talk to other people about it. I think that's going to be of huge value to plenty of people listening in.
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm really grateful for the opportunity. And like you said, I hope this helps people from all walks and corners of life. So, yeah, super grateful, and thank you so much.
Thanks, Taylor.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love if you would hit that subscribe button, leave a comment or a review, and share it with anyone you think might enjoy it as well. For more behind the scenes content, head to my Instagram at davidmead411 and feel free to slide into my DMs if there's anyone you would love to hear from. I can't wait to bring you another episode next week, and thanks for listening to the David Mead Podcast.